Hi, I'm Carrie Dubick, and I'm reading for the role of Man at Party Who Smells Fart. Great party. Thank you.
Okay, great. Let's go again, but this time I think the fart is just bigger and fatter.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 236 for the week of January 28th, 2019. I am the next big white kid, David T. Cole, and I'm here with party fun, Sarah D. Bunting.
In this climate?
Workout wig, Tara Ariano.
No one will know it's me, stealing exercise!
And proud gay survivor fan, Joe Reed.
We exist!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Before we get into it, just a little bit of site business, and that is this. I finally have the Patreon page up. So if you've been itching to send us a couple bucks every month, now is your chance. We are linked up on the extrahotgreat.com site. But if you want to go directly there right now, check the show notes or go to patreon.com/extrahotgreat. We have various tiers from $2 up to $100, all named after some of my favorite Simpsons things. So go check that out. We have one perk for the whole system. Every $400, if we're so lucky to get that much, we will add what I am calling an extra, extra hot great. It's something more than the minis, but less than an episode. You know, something maybe 15, 20 minutes long. That will do one a month of for every $400 we have, up to one a week, you know, because we're going to be making $3,000 in donations at any moment. Cough. Okay. With that, I send it over to Tara. And thank you, everybody, once again, for poking us and prodding us to get that going.
Welcome our guest, our beloved Joe Reed. Hi, Joe.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Yay! Hey! So we wanted to talk about the Comedy Central sitcom The Other Two this week. And since before we even decided this, I had seen Joe tweeting about the screeners, I thought, literally, who better to join us discuss this? Joe, why don't you give our listeners a rundown of what the show is?
Sure. So the show comes from writers and former Saturday Night Live showrunners, Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, who... Chris Kelly had done the independent film Other People a few years ago. A couple years ago, it had won Molly Shannon Independent Spirit Award. They were sort of holding up for a while the kind of Kate McKinnon, A.D. Bryant end of SNL. It's sort of ironic that their year as showrunners, or head writers rather, was the year of like the Trump sort of explosion at SNL, where it became all sort of Alec Baldwin Trump all the time. It's anyway. This show is nothing like that. This show is much, much more their sensibility. If you have a feel for their sensibility, it is about the two adult siblings of essentially like a early phase teen breakout star in the sort of Justin Bieber mold, in like broad strokes only. The kid's stage name is Chase Dreams, and he's actually like this really sort of sweet kid who is going through this incredible experience of having this pop hit breakout, and Molly Shannon's the mother. The adult siblings, though, are played by Drew Tarver and Helena York, and are fantastically funny in their sort of dismay at being the kind of adult cautionary tales of failure to compare their younger sibling to, who is now this like breakout success. But also one of the sort of, you know, brilliant things about the show is that this kid isn't shitty Bieber clone. This is a pretty good kid. They genuinely love their brother. They want the best for him, as they are also sort of bemoaning their own kind of disastrous lives. He's gay. He's trying to be an actor. It's not working, as you heard in the intro.
The older brother is, not the kid.
Yes. Sorry. Carrie, the older brother, played by Drew Tarver, is a struggling actor. You heard at the beginning the fart commercial that he's auditioning for. Brooke, the sister, played by Helena York, is sort of a unsuccessful realtor and sleeping, you know, the cliched sort of like sleeping in the house that you're showing off kind of a thing. But she sort of even breaks out from there. You find out that she had wanted to be a dancer. That was her sort of big like dream that failed. And then pretty soon into the season, I think even by episode two, she becomes Chase's manager, which, you know, the possibilities of that really begin to pay off down the road in the season. I've seen 9 of the first 10 episodes of the 10 episodes. I guess they gave us the whole season, I would imagine.
Yes, in screeners, we should say, for the listeners.
Yes.
You cannot binge all of these. We have screener privilege, and we could. She starts out as his assistant. It's not until much later in the season that they float the idea of her being his manager.
Right, that's what it is. It's his assistant. Sorry. All those things were interchangeable to me, Tara. I'm so not Hollywood. I don't get it at all.
I know. You're not plugged in. I saw Chris, to speak to the sweetness of Chase's character, Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider were on Seth Meyers last week, and they talked about how the original conception of the show might have been that he was more shitty, but then they thought it's more interesting.
It's so much more interesting.
If he's nice and they like him, like they want good things to happen for him, they just want to like glom onto his fame and like,
right.
You know,
it's the unexpected thing. At this point, we've seen the other way before, the more sort of cynical and more acidic kind of way. I feel like that's the more expected way to go. This is much more unexpected and interesting.
Yeah, I laughed a ton. Sarah, the sitcom usually hater. What did you think?
Well, way to lead with something that involved farts.
Sure.
I mean, come on. I just loved all the little things around the edges. Like, first of all, the fact that, speaking of unexpected, I liked that the adult siblings seem aware of their own wretchedness.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the more standard thing is for them to be oblivious. That's right. Like the sitcom trope is like,
yeah.
That's why you have a so-called straight man, because someone's acting ridiculous. And they both seem fairly aware, like when they cut through a limo to get onto this red carpet and he's like, and I brought napkins and then just does this like tiny eye roll. And then the scenes with him and at the restaurant and his manager who keeps announcing all of these like aspects of gay culture that he's consumed. And the coworker was like, see you at Pride. And then just like leaves the scene. And yeah, that's really well done. The manager played by Ken Marino.
Yes.
Is perfect. And they know just how absurd and surreal to make it, like that they're, you know, he can't talk right now. He's dying his tongue. And like, he can't talk right now. We've strapped down his Adam's apple and this kid is just sitting there. Oh my God. It's so good. But they get to like the sort of funny truth of these like failures, but not. And all sorts of little truths around the edges of someone becoming famous in this way, like when he's on the red carpet and it's like the Bagel Bites live stream, which that's like low hanging fruit. But then they also do the like, you know, red or yellow. And he's like red, but yellow's tight, too. Like just that it's impossible for them to actually have an opinion on anything lest they tarnish the brand. And then the next question naturally is Israel or Palestine. And he's like, guy,
my favorite small moment of the whole first season, which we watched all of. And it's a Ken Marino as his manager Streeter moment. And he has this tendency, which I also do, which is if nobody replies, I just keep on filling the silence with more stuff. And the further it goes along, the less sense it makes. And there's this one chain that ends with him saying, Chase Dream, he's like a father to me.
Yeah.
Yes. That was like, oh man, I've been there. I said something that dumb and just like the opposite of what you wanted to say. And it just rung true. And it was, oh no, that's me.
I will also say the When in Nome premiere.
Oh yeah.
Everyone is passed out
asleep. Yeah.
Sleeping. And then the little lines of dialogue that you do hear, like their touch with that stuff is perfect because this is stuff that's really easy to lampoon and they never go too far and they like there's little sharp observations and then they move on to the next thing and they don't always do what you expect. So I really enjoyed it. I only watched 2, but I'm in. I really liked it.
It's
I wanted to comment on that restraint too. Sorry, Joe, if I may just jump on that. that there are a lot of points where I expected there to be like, and don't get me wrong, I love 30 Rock, but I expected like a 30 Rockian cutaway to like someone's memory. Like, for example, I think it's a few episodes in, Chase's publicist comes and like has a whole binder of all of Brooke's like social media fuck ups that they need to like manage. And when they're listing these moments, or Carrie can remember like three particular instances that he rhymes off, and you kind of expect that they're going to like cut away to show us those moments, and they don't. Like, they're, despite the ridiculousness and that potential in the premise, they don't, like, they keep it very, they keep it grounded, and I appreciate it.
I will jump in here because I actually clipped one of those moments you just talked about. Uh-huh. And granted, this is from the third episode, so it doesn't spoil the plot at all, but obviously you will hear the joke. And this is the last bit of what Tara was talking about. They're basically doing background and everybody see what skeletons they have in their closet, see what social media fuck-ups they've done in the past. And Carrie, thank you. I always want to say Casey. He just like has this fire hose of things he's talking about. Nobody's ever going to find out about because it didn't happen online. And this is the last one. And this just made me cackle out loud. Here we go.
And when I was 23, I worked at a hotel and Christopher Maloney stayed there. And one day he went out to the pool. So I snuck into his room and smelled his underwear. But then he returned to a different room. So I don't know whose underwear I smelled.
Oh, it's so good.
And what a perfect choice of celebrity.
Oh, yeah.
For Maloney.
Well, among us, right, guys?
Exactly.
That's sort of my thing with it, too, is it's such a well-observed show in terms of the references that it chooses to make. I was making my notes for talking about this, and I started to write down that it's not too dense in its references. But then I stopped and I'm like, it is very dense, but you don't feel manic or oppressed by that density. There's a lot of references, but the show feels very sort of at ease with it. But like, honest to God, there were multiple moments throughout this whole season where I'm just like, wait a second, like, this is me, not just the Survivor thing, although I should say.
I'll describe that because that's very good.
The joke in the first episode that, because Carrie's got the straight roommate who he's attracted to, and like the cool, like the twist on it is like he, like they will like make out and sort of like vaguely hook up in a way that is still fully inscrutable and frustrating to Carrie, which is like really fun little ongoing thing. But so he and Brooke are later talking about how straight could this guy be, and he's like, well, he watches old seasons of Survivor, and that show is, and then they both at the same time are like violently heterosexual. And so I was texting our friend Kevin O'Keefe, and I was just like, damn it, like that one really got to me. And so and the joke sort of recurs later in the season, and it mentions, and the guy's like, well, not Micronesia, because Carrie's like, every season is the same stuff happens, and he goes, not Micronesia, and Carrie just goes, yeah, that was a game changer. So I was on Twitter talking about the show and about how the Survivor joke in the pilot, you know, cut me to the quick, with my friend Caroline, who writes for Caroline Framka, who writes at Variety. And we were chatting about this, and Chris Kelly like responds to the chain that we're talking about. And he's just like, he said that Survivor thing was based on me, because I've watched every season of Survivor and I'm totally obsessed with it and whatever. And I'm just like, of course, because like that's the only that kind of observation can come from that kind of knowing of a thing. There's a later thing later in the season where Brooke mentions the Rolling Stone cover with Justin Timberlake shirtless with the turquoise jewelry. And I'm like, I held onto that cover for years. Like, it's so well. There's a great Deborah Messing joke at the end of the premiere episode that I literally was like, how did I not text Tara immediately after I saw that? Because it really gets, it's like a next level. It also reminded me a little bit of Difficult People.
Yeah.
But like, what if Difficult People didn't feel the need to be so aggressively arch all the time? I liked Difficult People, but there was something about Difficult People that was like, needed you to know that it was like 10 times smarter than everything that was going on.
Yeah.
And I think the other two just sort of lives in it and sits in it and is there with you. And I really love that about it.
Yeah, I agree. I like that the finding the absurdity in how lonely it can be
like,
in this city. trying to do your art or whatever, like that those things can coexist comfortably and they don't feel the need to be like, but you know, but it's funny, but it's also sad that it's
Carrie
like,
doing the dancing thing for the ride was so bleak.
Doing the flash mob.
Oh,
yeah.
The flash mob for the ride. Oh my God.
And the whole like, not like fun, but party fun.
Uh-huh.
Like, that, I mean, that's very true, but then they didn't linger on it. So.
Yep.
And Lance is so.
Oh, Lance.
Delightful. Lance, who dabs all the time.
Love Lance.
And still
Lance.
Says, damn Daniel.
Lance is played by Jason Segarra, who was on Sirens also. He was the main guy's girlfriend's partner, cop partner. And he also, I guess, had a villain arc on Arrow for a while. And I thought at the time, not that I watch Arrow, but like, what a waste of such an amazing, like, just natural comic talent. And he was
so
kind of
funny.
Like a cute dum dum on Sirens as well, but like he really does it so well. He must be super smart in real life because he makes these characters like just so winning. I mean, I was totally in the tank for Lance by the end of it.
Yeah, same. There's also an Instagaze episode in the middle of the season that you need to see. I don't even want to talk about it. It's just, it's like episode 5. You need to see it to believe it. It's so incredibly accurate.
It's episode 7. I had to, when it was starting, I had to like pause it and try to explain the Instagaze subculture to Dave. And I don't think that he totally like believed what I was telling him
until
there was a moment in the episode, and spoiler, mild spoiler, not a plot spoiler either, where they're like this, the main Instagaze and his like three friends who all have the same name almost are in like triathlete or wrestling singlets. And they're like, he's like, where are you? Carrie asks, where are you going? They're like, oh, we just took a picture in front of a school that burned down. Like, it's so good. Oh God.
You're right. I still don't quite understand. Like, are they doing that knowingly or is it just like,
no.
Okay.
No.
All right.
No, they're thirst traps. Remember when I explained to you what a thirst trap was?
Yeah.
That's what they are. They're just in it for likes and to add their followers and look hot. That's
okay.
All.
No, but I mean like them posing in front of some sort of disaster zone. Like.
That's to seem deep, I think. I'm shrugging, Joe.
And also to bring, they would say we're bringing awareness to a terrible thing that happened.
Like with hot bodies. Okay, I get it. All right.
Yes. Yeah.
Along that lines, I really enjoyed the scenes with him and his gay waiter friend when they're talking to their boss and their boss who is digging little bits of gay culture and sort of trying to get credit for it, starting with the viewing of Brokeback Mountain and the pilot. And then it escalates as the show goes on. But just sort of their reaction, which is... thank you for your service to the gay community, which is like the path of least resistance to getting out of this conversation.
Yeah.
I thought it was fantastic.
Brandon Scott Jones plays the waiter friend who also showed up in the Good Place finale as the gossip blogger. And then he's also in the new Rebel Wilson movie, which I saw him in the trailer for. So I'm like all within like the same week. Mm-hmm. I'm like, we're having a moment with Brandon Scott Jones. I'm very happy with this.
Yeah, he's funny.
Yeah.
It's a great show. I don't know what else we can say. I will say
so much.
When you get to the end of the season, there's 10 episodes. It airs Thursdays at 10:30 on Comedy Central after Broad City. If you enjoyed this story of two hangers-on of a famous entertainment celebrity's career, may Dave and I also recommend Champagne Ill. This was the show that sort of was unceremoniously released like in the hammock between Christmas and New Year's on YouTube Premium ? Which is another streaming service you can pay money for.
Yeah.
You but and your this, Google Plus.
Okay. I know. This the first three episodes are free, but it's it stars Sam Richardson from Veep and Detroiters and Adam Pally from Happy Endings. The two of them are friends with this guy who's a rapper. They all went to high school together, and the rapper guy gets a record deal right after their graduation. So they just go and follow him around on tour for like the next 10 years and never develop any skills or like live life. And then something happens to the rapper friend and they have to figure out what they're going to do with the rest of their lives. So it's a similar kind of premise. Very, very funny show. Also 10 episodes, I think.
It's not as good as this. It's also not as good as Detroiters.
No, this is better, but...
but it will scratch an itch. It is time for Around the Dial. First stop, Tara Ariano.
I wanted to do a quick check-in with several shows that I've mentioned recently. Good Trouble, quit that show. Lindsay Lohan's Beach Club, quit that show. Outlander, probably about to quit that show. I haven't finished the season finale yet, but it seems like they're pivoting to make it more about their dumb daughter and her idiot fiance, and I don't care. And I quit, probably will quit that show too. And after the season three finale, please hold your tomatoes. I'm probably going to quit The Good Place. It's such a slog for me now. Like, all of the charm of it has gone. And the reason is it has, because its stakes are the highest stakes possible, it also has no stakes at all. And the problem is, like, they, you know, it's fine if you want to change the game and completely, like, just upend your whole premise from time to time. But it's like, it feels like they're doing it on a mid-episode basis at this point.
They do it a lot. Yeah.
They're describing stuff where it's like, we can't do this or else. And they, okay, first of all, they keep describing like these horrible tortures that they're going to suffer if everything goes wrong, which nothing ever goes wrong, really. And we're going to have to see some of those tortures if those jokes are going to keep landing, because you can't just describe these horrible fates and then not have it actually befall anyone that we see on camera, or else, like, I don't believe you.
Oh, Tara's got
I don't believe. Well, I mean, that's not a surprise, but. The problem is, like, a premise like this is, it's like sci-fi where anything can happen, and that's just, like, anything can write you out of, like, the plot holes that you put yourself in, where it's like, well, all of a sudden there's a judge. Where did the judge come from? Is the judge God? We don't know. If this actual hell, doesn't seem that bad. It's just a bad party. We have to go through this portal. Now we have to go through this portal. Now we're all in Janet's dimension or whatever. Like, it just, it feels like it could keep going like this forever. And if the central point of,
you know what it feels like? It feels like it's getting, a virus from Doctor Who.
Yeah,
it has Whovian nonsensical happenings, which is like kind of the part of Doctor Who it always loses me. Mm-hmm. And I feel what you're saying here in regards to that anyways.
Yeah. I mean, we got to the end of the finale and I was like, I don't care about this show anymore. Like, if the purpose of it is to get Chidi and Eleanor together, like, that's a bad purpose, because those two have no chemistry. I do not buy them as a couple. And especially in the finale where it was like, let's watch these highlights from their wonderful relationship as it grew over time. It's like, we never saw any of this shit. Like, this is just a montage of stuff that never happened in our universe as far as, like, we've seen. Like, I know people want to love the show, and I get it, but, like, it's just, to me, it's like it's edged too far into sci-fi where it's like, now I feel like they accomplished, you know, the purpose of, like, getting people to be better. Like, that was the whole point of the season two finale until they decided to make her shitty again with Eleanor. It's like, you had me. Oh, you lost me again. It's like, if the point of this is, like, existence on Earth is Sisyphean, there's no relief for any of us. Like, I don't need to watch this show.
Yeah.
Anyway, Joe, defend your show.
Well, so it's interesting because, like, all of the sort of structural criticisms, I have to agree. Like, yes, I think all of that is true. I would have loved for them to have lingered for, like, a whole season on Earth where they were sort of doing good deeds for people and helping people.
Sure.
Out. That seemed to be like a good little sweet spot for them. You had the good, the cool episode with, like, Jason's family. And then you had, like, Eleanor with her mother, with Leslie Grossman, who, you know, I love.
Of course.
And that they sort of whiplashed out of that so quickly. I was like that too. I was just like, wait, I guess we're just switching things up again. And I wonder if maybe part of that is the idea of, like, we don't know how much more show we're going to get. So, you know, got to, like, fast forward it. But to me, accepting all of those criticisms, I can sort of sweep that away, because for me, whatever the place setting and whatever even the plot is going on is sort of an excuse for me to watch this collection of characters sort of bounce off of each other in a way that, like, and I know that sort of sounds like excuse making or whatever, but, like, this show in particular feels like it just sort of is a playpen for these characters. And so anytime there's, like, I still find Darcy Carden to be one of the funniest people on television and doing, like, one of the funniest things. I love every little new bit of, like, what they bring out of Tahani. I think you're right about Eleanor and Chidi. I'm fond of them enough as individual characters that I'm just like, you want them, go for it. Like, good for you. Make it. You know what I mean? Probably won't work, but you know what? Like, everybody deserves to go. I sort of feel that way about Janet and Jason, too, sort of. It's like, I don't feel like this pressing need to have them. Shows do have a problem with aggressive need to couple everybody up.
Yeah.
It's the Friends thing.
Yep.
Where it was just like, remember, it seemed like they were going to try and put Phoebe and Joey together for a while there because it just like, we got to get them all. We got to like, we got to pair them all off as quickly as possible.
And Joey and Rachel, too. That was a thing.
Well, that was a whole other. Yeah, for sure. But I still love the characters enough that I'm still on board with the, like, you're not wrong. And I can see a future where like those bad seeds kind of, you know, the weeds from all of that become too much and I can't get through it anymore.
Well, what's going to happen is the cycle where they go back to the roots is going to hit soon-ish, I think. So there's going to be some other reset where it kind of goes back to adjacent to the original premise, I believe. I mean, that's just usually how these things go. When you get a show that seems addicted to change, eventually they'll go back to the roots. And that's sort of like, at what point in the planned arc is it, does that happen? Because I would bet a lot of money on that happening.
Well, it's like there's a judge and there's accountants. It's like there's too much mythology in this show. I mean, I just like, by the time they got to the scene where like Janet was, you know, wrecking everyone in a fucking bar brawl, I was like, all right, this is Axe Cop now. Like, if you want to watch that show, that's fine. Like, I get it. But at the same time, I feel like it might be a function of like I think the show is only okay. Plus, the critical response to it is like, just so like, oh, the philosophy we're all learning. And oh my God, the greater questions it's raising about existence and blah, blah, blah. It's like nails on a chalkboard. So like those two things, at the same time, it's like, to me, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is a far superior show and it doesn't get anywhere near as much love as it should compared to this sucking all the air. Well, out of the room.
The other problem is sort of like the problem with how Alias always went back to amnesia well with various characters.
Yeah.
Like that's what this show has been lately. It's like taking people's memories out of the game, sort of either en masse or a couple at a time or one at a time, you know, and now Eleanor is the one that knows what's going on and other people don't. Like, at a certain point, you kind of feel like you're getting cheated out of character development when that happens. And I feel like amnesia is right up there for me with time travel and shapeshifters, where it kind of feels like they could have figured out a better way to get where they wanted to go that they did using amnesia as a tool.
I will say, Jason Mantzoukas as an evolved sex idiot, yes.
Yeah.
Yes to all of it. Absolutely. They put him in a tux? Yes.
100%. Anyway, see you guys all on Twitter where everyone's going to be yelling at me about their favorite fucking show. Anyway, for my plug, I mentioned this last week, but now they have actually started. I'm writing recaps for Decider.com of the new TNT true crime drama, I Am the Night, with Chris Pine, directed by Patty Jenkins. So I will link them in the show notes, but go over to Decider.com and check them out.
Where is the rent? I must have the rent. Dollars, dimes, and nickels, I need them all right now.
I'm so glad you clipped from actual Rent Live. That's so fantastic. I did watch Rent Live on Sunday night. I went to the home of frequent Extra Hot Great guest Adam Grossworth, who was naturally throwing a party with themed foodstuffs and whatnot to watch Rent. It was billed as Rent Live. It was very, very much not live. It was Rent taped from Friday night before because the guy playing Roger, Brennan Hunt, broke his foot on Saturday. And so they used the rehearsal footage from Friday for 90% of the show. They all sort of pulled it back together for the closing number, in part because the closing number included all of the original cast members from the original Rent who were not there for the Friday dress rehearsal, I imagine. So it was a strange sort of thing. I think my threshold for enjoyment for these live musicals is very low. I'm just like, you're putting this on. Okay. Like, it'll be a shit show. Sure. Fun thing to do on Saturday or on Sunday with my friends. And so it's another one of those things where it's just like, were the criticisms like justified? Yeah. There was a whole thing about whether there should have been an understudy for this guy because, you know, that's why you have understudies on regular Broadway shows. And
right.
and whether the rehearsal footage that was filmed, were people sort of going half speed or three quarter speed because it was only a rehearsal. I would defer to somebody like Adam, who is more knowledgeable than that than I. And he was sort of tweeting yesterday that he didn't see a whole lot of half speed stuff, and that the understudy thing, while would have been nice, is probably not too feasible for a show where you're only putting on one production.
Yeah.
One sort of, you know, performance. So I get it. It just sort of seems like one of those, like, it is kind of the live TV disaster. It's just that your live TV disaster happened the day before you were supposed to go live. A lot of people did not come off very well. I think Valentina, who we all, if not love on Drag Race, at least appreciate watching the whole telenovela of it all with Valentina. A lot of people were really looking forward to her playing Angel, and she was not good. Like,
oh,
the energy was there. The notes were not there. Like, there was, you know, she was a presence and she was fun and whatever. And the costumes that they did for her were actually really amazing. But, yeah, the singing wasn't there. But in a really pleasant surprise, they cast Vanessa Hudgens as Maureen. I loved her. I thought she was great. She sort of comes in about maybe a third of the way into the show, and she was like a huge little burst of energy, and I thought she was great and really committed and sort of funny in a way that I'm not usually used to Vanessa Hudgens being. And then Brandon Victor Dixon.
She was in Grease, wasn't she? Wasn't she Rizzo in Grease?
Yes, yes, right. Which I did not watch, but yes, she was. And she has played Mimi in some sort of production of Rent, whether it's like a Hollywood Bowl thing or something. She had yeah. been Mimi before. So she has experience with this, but even still, I was like, I guess I'm not used to seeing Vanessa Hudgens in the context where she's good. I'm mostly just like, she's a judge on So You Think You Can Dance, and she's sort of annoying and that kind of thing. But good for her, and I was very happy. And then they cast Brandon Victor Dixon, who had been in Jesus Christ Superstar last spring. He was Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar and was fantastic. And he was fantastic again. He was played Tom Collins. He has the big sort of very sad number in the second act where he sings I'll Cover You at the funeral for the Angel character. And he was wonderful. So, like, it wasn't a total loss. I think, again, it's sort of one of those excuses for everybody to kind of huddle around, if not like a party with your friends, like your, you know, your Twitter account or whatever, and just sort of like make jokes with people and have a good time. I don't think there were enough big wow moments, but like, I was satisfied enough. I don't know. I think for something where disaster happened, I think yeah. it could have gone a lot worse. So I don't know. I'll be lenient. I'll mention for my plug, because my first of my plugs is my podcast, This Had Oscar Buzz,
woo!
Which has been going strong now for several months. My co-host Chris File and I just put up the episode where we look back at the class of 2018, all of the Oscar Buzz hopefuls for this year that mm-hmm. as of last Tuesday and the nominations failed to materialize. So
suck a dick, the mule.
Yes, seriously. Seriously. Sorry about it. Life itself.
Oh, God.
Can you also talk about the upcoming live event that you have planned with this podcast, please? Oh,
yes. So one of the recurring themes that we've found as we've gone through these movies that didn't quite get Oscar attention was that a lot of them did get nominations from the AARP, who annually give out their AARP Movies for Grown-Ups Awards, which was not a thing.
It
was not a thing I knew existed before we started doing this podcast, but it's one of those, if you open the IMDb tab for a movie, it's one of those weird little ancillary awards. So they've showed up in enough of our movies that we've talked about that we've grown to love them because their taste is very specific and very demographically appropriate and in many ways kind of cool. So we have decided that this year the AARP Movies for Grownups Awards are being telecast on PBS 10 whole days after they're handed out in real life. They're handed out on February 5th. They won't be on television until the 15th. But on the 15th, Chris and I are going to hop on Twitter and we're going to live tweet the AARP Movies for Grownups Awards for whoever wants to follow us on our podcast feed, which is had_Oscar_buzz. So please come and follow us there. And we will have a good old time with that on February 15th. follow the podcast. We really have a really lot of fun doing it. We do have an episode coming up on Rent the Movie. So we're sort of, you know, in the spirit of things in that way. And yeah, it's very fun. And then also on the podcasting tip, I will be a special guest on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. We are recording very soon. I don't know how much you want to talk about what we're going to be talking about, but
we're doing it's gonna be great. You'll be with us for a couple of episodes. You're pitching in on a Cranberries request from a listener, but
I sure am.
Your truest lane that you dominate, of course, is the Oscars episode, and we are doing a Star Is Born Oscar nominated song, Face Off. Gaga v. Barbara.
Love it.
It's going to get actually not that ugly. It's going to get pretty fun. I'm excited for it.
I am too.
Yay!
All right, Sarah, what do you have?
Football, obviously. I'm here to talk about QB1 Beyond the Lights Season 2, which I think actually came out last year, but because it was like a show on an app, which like I had the app, but you just don't. Like, it's not an app that you use for anything else. So I kind of had it on my list to watch it because I really liked the first season and I did review it on previously.tv. Now, both seasons are on Netflix. And as ever, if you liked Friday Night Lights and or Last Chance U, you will like the show. It follows three quarterbacks each year, most of whom have already promised Division I football programs that they're going to go there. And then they're sort of ups and downs as the season continues. The kids are more uniformly likable this year, by which I mean none of them is Tate Martell. Sorry, buddy, but you were a cock. The real star of the show, I think, in season two is the coach of the hapless but rebuilding Oceanside Collegiate Land Sharks. their mascot is also amazing. This is a very enthusiastic dancer whose costume does not appear to have a dorsal fin. Free the land shark. Anyway, the coach is named Chad something, which on this show is not helpful because people, there are so many fucking Chads. It is a show about football, literal and figurative Chads everywhere. Chad is trying to halt this program back from an 0-8 showing in the previous season that had featured a handful of ass beatings that probably should have been mercy ruled. And he has imported Sam Hartman from one state over to help him turn things around. Chad is yelly the way all football coaches are, but he also has a subtle snark to him that I found enjoyable. Occasionally, he would ask plaintively from the sidelines in practice if wide receivers wanted to try making the catch instead, just for a change of pace. So season two was good. Dan and I got sucked right into it, but it felt more elliptical and impressionistic than the first season, and not necessarily in a good way. The effect of the injuries on the commitments to the schools isn't really discussed. The subject of concussions and concussion protocol is studiously avoided, in my opinion, which I find weird, especially like this high school. These are high school players, like that needs to be a part of the story. It's a little unclear. One of the quarterbacks has actually a pretty terrible season and heads to his school in mid-year. And I can deduce why, but it like give us a chyron, like tell us he graduated early. Like I just sort of didn't understand what like where he was in the journey, except for the fact that we were in the season finale. And there seems to be a not entirely workable walled off quality to mentions of the QBs from the previous season. Like two out of three of the guys that we see this year have signed with schools where a previous quarterback from this show is already ensconced. Like, what? And then one of them left to take the place of the third one? I should have brought a whiteboard. Sorry. I mean, it's still a good slice of life show. The episodes are like 33-ish minutes long each, and they kind of roll right into each other. And cumulatively, you really get a sense of the pressure that these young men are under and have been under since they were like 9. in some cases, all the more reason to pay NCAA athletes. I am not a crackpot, but I hope that if there is a season three, they push a little harder on some of the problematic aspects of football, especially as played by young people, by which I mean all of them. For my plug, this isn't really a plug, but Professor Buncey begins her college instructional career as you're listening to this tomorrow. The projected high for my first day at Tisch is 14 with a wind chill factor of 2. So my section is full, but I'm not actually sure anyone's going to show up. So if you're near NYU and you just want to hop in and keep warm and watch some family sitcoms and listen to me talk about them and swear a lot, I am teaching a class at NYU's School of Dramatic Writing. I am pretty excited about it. And I encourage people to call me Professor Buncey as a joke.
No, for real. Forever.
All right. The last little chunk of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt has aired, or landed rather, on Netflix. I was sort of like, okay, it's over, it's done. There was no standout episodes, I felt, in like compared to standout episodes in previous seasons. The still one of my favorite episodes, beyond, of course, the Dionne Warwick episode, which is in the canon.
Thanks to Joe.
Yes, is the now what that's what we call music knockoff episode, which still is one of my favorite memories of this show. It feels like the show sort of had run its course as the seasons went on. It became less Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and more Fantabulous, you know, Titus show, which I think is a slow but correct adjustment. Titus is such a fantastic character, and I think the writers had a lot of fun writing him, obviously, and they kind of ran out of things to do with Kimmy and the initial premise of the show, you know, that she was taken and now she is a fish out of water in society. I found the ending very pat, which I wasn't expecting from this show. Sort of how Kimmy's life is resolved. It starts really strong.
I liked that. Well, that first episode starts with that Living Single parody that I was like, a gasp at how good that was. And then there's a Venga Boys joke in that episode that made me laugh so hard that like it was so unexpected. But it's like, that's the kind of thing that the show at its best can do for you. There was also the good thing about Jacqueline and Lillian, and I can't remember Amy Sedaris's character.
Maybe.
All become like gross ladies in the way that like gross men are. And you're like in this sort of like reverse Me Too in a way that's just like, I don't know if I like where this is going, but then they all gather at like Bed Bath and Beyond and like, like skis on these young guys. And it was just like, okay, this is, they did manage to make it funny. So I thought the first half of this season was kind of a trend up from where it had been the last few before that. I thought they had finally figured out that like, oh, right. Put Jacqueline with all the other characters instead of on these weird Washington Redskins excursions.
Side quests. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think you're right about Titus, I think, and about Kimmy. And it's weird that they weren't able to find more possibilities to take that Kimmy character, because it still feels like there was a lot of
totally
left on that bone in terms of like things they could have done with her. They just sort of never did. It's a show I will always feel fondly towards, but I never think about it when I think of like, what are the great comedies that I've loved? I never think about it that way, but I always am fond of it. So
I'll say this about the last little dribble of the show is, if the trade-off for having that one standalone episode that was all about the DJ career of Richard Wayne, Gary Wayne in the first half was that all we get of that character in the back half is, spoiler alert, his voice, bad trade. That was the one character that I was most disappointed she didn't get to have more closure with.
Thought for sure that was going to be a coda at the end of the of the series, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my preference is always for more ham, but, you know, I didn't think the ending was pat. I thought it was sweet. It worked on me, but I'm more of a sap, probably.
Part of the problem, I think, is Netflix splitting a season. It doesn't really work on Netflix like it does when you're consuming something a week at a time. Like, instead of getting all 12 or whatever episodes we usually get in a season, you know, we got half and half. And there's something about binging half a season on Netflix that it just feels weird, truncated, and sort of start-stoppy that I wasn't really expecting, but I was just like, okay, just kind of start. Like, you're so used to spending like a full day if you're really dedicated, or like a whole weekend with Kimmy Schmidt. And but this time we were like done in an afternoon. We're like, okay, well.
I also had the thought as I was watching yesterday, I was like, I don't know if I've done a last season with Netflix yet. And it's very weird to have a last bunch of episodes drop at the same time, where it's like, because we're so used to the way that shows end, which is, you know, build up some sort of retrospective time. We all sort of have our moment to see where we think things are going. And there's that like week between the penultimate episode and the last episode where we wonder how they're going to end it off.
Joe, you're forgetting about House of Cards, your favorite show.
Well, but did that actually end?
Yeah.
I had stopped watching that so long ago. I didn't know whether we had one more Robin Wright season left in us or not.
No, that was the season that just dropped in the fall.
Oh, okay.
But yes, it's about to happen again.
This is the first time we've had a last season that people want to watch. So
yes, it's about to happen again with Orange is the New Black.
Yes.
Right, I guess this year too.
It's just an odd experience where it's just like, it doesn't feel like there's any occasion to it or any buildup.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they fix that. I don't know what they would do differently.
Well, yeah, because you got two crowds. You got the race to the end, first one out of the gate. But then you have like everybody else, and everybody's ending at a different time. It just does. It's sort of like the inverse of the you know, starting. Everybody's out of the gate and you hear all this buzz, but it's sort of like doesn't really work.
Unless you do like the Downton Abbey, like Christmas special, you know, finale movie thing where, you know, you get it up to almost the end and then you wait a few months and then they did that with Sense8, actually.
That would be a smart model.
Sense8 ended really, really satisfyingly in that way. So maybe that is, you know.
For my plug, I just want to say, go to Extra Hot Great. Click on the guests tab. Recently, I spent some time shoring all that up, and I was quite pleased with the results. That's all I'll say. ExtraHotGreat.com. And then check out our guest list.
Yeah. This extra credit topic comes to us from Dan Casino. I have titled it Technical Awards. Dave, you have to add something to that form so people can give their things their own titles, because I'm not always great at coming up with them. See this week as example. But anyway, the excellent topic, my name aside, is the fact that a show is technically adept doesn't mean it'll be for everyone, especially when there are so many good shows on the air. Dan Casino, so true. Dan asks, what show do you recognize as good but just can't get into? This will come as no, I'll go first. This will come as no surprise to anyone who's listened to the show for any period of time, but it is Game of Thrones. I recognize it is extremely well made. People who are fanatical about the source material love it or have loved it. Maybe they've fallen off in more recent years. Don't know, don't care, because that kind of sci fantasy stuff is not for me, more for you, and I bless you with it. Joe.
I almost said The Americans, because that was sort of the show that I had fallen off with early, that, you know, people really went strong for. Yeah. But I don't feel like I can't really say The Americans like isn't a show for me, because in many ways it is. It just sort of was kind of a victim of circumstance with me. I went with Better Call Saul because that is a show I never really started with, in part because by the time it showed up, I guess I was burnt out on Breaking Bad, which isn't to say I didn't like Breaking Bad by the end. But I was, once that show ended, I was like, okay, I need a break. I need some time off of this. And that Better Call Saul happened so quickly. I was just like, you know what? I'm not gonna. And then I believe everybody who, you know, with all the good things they say about it, the little bits that I've seen of the show, if I'll like watch an episode for, you know, purposes here or there to review or to talk about it on a podcast or whatever, I've liked what I've seen. I sort of root for it, even when it's like nominated for Emmys. I want Rhea Seehorn to be more of a thing. I think she's wonderful. I just had to sort of triage and make a decision, and Better Call Saul ended up on the other side of the canal for me. And that's sort of how we're going to have to be. And maybe one day I will go back and revisit it.
It sounds like when you go to you discover a restaurant, you're like, oh my God, the food here is so good. Then you go like way too many times in a 2 week period. And then you're like, oh no. My taste buds, I've ruined them for...
Yeah, you know. I've done it. Yeah.
Sarah.
I'm going to go with Superstore. I hated that shit on site when it premiered 3 years ago, but it was a pilot. People whose opinions I trust and respect really liked the show and said things about it that made me think I maybe would like this sitcom. So I gave it another shot. I no longer would cross the street to kick it in the shins, but this is not a genre that I enjoy on its own merits. Usually this, like, I see where people are coming from. I see that it's well built. Like, if I sort of turn it over and look at the back, I'm like, yes, this tapestry shows a professional level of craftsmanship, but I don't have time for it. So sorry, Superstore. You're no longer, you know, super shitty, but you're just Store to me. Sorry.
Ben Feldman is so hot. No, I agree with you, but also
know.
Ben Feldman is the hottest. Yeah, no,
that's why I tried again. I'm not going to lie.
It's on my list for when it comes on in syndication somewhere. That's when I will pick it up mom style.
You'll mom it. Yeah.
It's like my favorite sitcom on network TV. Sorry, all go. The other shows.
Okay, I'll finish us up. Mine is Stranger Things. And this is a show that I really kind of felt like on paper, it was something that I would want to watch. As we said, when it first came out, I recognize that it is well-crafted, perhaps too well-crafted in the sense that I felt like its nostalgia angle was grown in a lab and it was sort of hitting me over the head with its use of nostalgia and homagerie, which is a word I just made up and I hope it catches on. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't get into it. And much like Tara and Game of Thrones, like after I decided I just can't, it's not quite for me. You know, I wasn't enjoying it enough to stick with it. Flips a switch in your brain, which is, well, now I'm never going to watch it because everybody else likes it so much. Fuck you, universe, I guess.
That'll show them.
But you know what? I kind of feel like it's always in the background. Like, you know, when Tara slips and falls on ice again and is in the hospital for 3 months, like maybe I'll watch it then. Like that's the kind of.
Sounds like you're making a plan, Dave.
No. Also, related to that, do not revisit Goonies as an adult. It so doesn't hold up.
I'm sorry. Yeah, we tried that.
Right now, don't do it. You can thank me on your deathbed.
I had a question for you, Dave.
Yes.
Which are you more likely to try to return to in your life?
Go on.
Stranger Things or The Man in the High Castle?
Oh, Stranger Things, because I think The Man in the High Castle just sort of like got super boring.
Yeah.
And like they're both high concept shows. The Man in the High Castle, the short story is very interesting. The start of Man in the High Castle, the TV show, was very interesting just because of the visuals they set up. And, you know, you were introduced to the world. So it's like all that world building introduction stuff that is sort of, for me, like when that sort of stuff is also alt history, you know, alternative history, like that is Dave Nip. I really love that stuff. But like after episode 3, I'm like, oh my God, this show is incredibly boring. It's so slow. Whereas Stranger Things, in order to rewatch it, I would just have to get in the mindset like, okay, David T. Cole, you are a child of the 80s. You lived through this period. You know, like all the millennials that love this show, like the 80s might as well be the 1880s, right? Like this is all just sort of like curated pop culture 80s-ness that is fun to watch in the same way that, you know, Back to the Future was fun to watch for me at the time, and all the 50s shit that I felt like that guy, that has to be extremely accurate in brackets. Yeah. Not at all. Not even the least. So I feel like if I could just get into the mindset just to flip that switch, turn that little bit off that says stop judging it on how manufactured its play and nostalgia is, that I could probably rewatch that one. I just don't really feel the need to make that happen anytime soon until something happens to you. Mumble, mumble, mumble.
Can I say about The Man in the High Castle, though, that is a show where if they had kicked that casting level up from like C-list to B-list, I would have been all over that show.
Yeah.
I was just so underwhelmed by like the level of casting where it was just like, oh, like, I don't know. It feels shallow
Julia
to say
sucked.
That.
Just say it.
I mean, yeah. I don't know. I just a higher class of actor, and I am all over that.
I thought you were about to say a higher class of Nazi. Like, okay.
Dave, I'm always looking for a higher class of Nazi.
A higher class.
We'll be right back after these messages. It's time for The Canon. Joe Reed is presenting this week. Take it away, Joe.
All right. Thank you. So this time for The Canon, I wanted to pick a show that hadn't been done before on Extra Hot Great, and brings, I wanted to bring the very best episode of something to the table. And since year-end best of lists were still prominently on my mind, I went with FX's Pose. I picked the season finale episode Mother of the Year, the first season finale, not only because I think that episode is indicative of what the show does best, but also because it exemplifies how the show had come a very long way over the course of its debut season. The episode takes its title seriously. Mother of the Year is not just an award that Blanca wins at the end. It is a structural blueprint for the hour, where Blanca essentially goes from character to character, offering help, concern, advice, or encouragement to various characters on the show. The idea of ball culture and house culture in the 1980s in New York City and Harlem and Uptown, the idea that these houses would create chosen families for their sort of wayward residents could start to sound quaint or cliche if it's repeated enough. But I think this episode really shows that there is family happening in these houses, particularly in the house of Evangelista. So we start with Blanca's arch rival, Electra, who at this point in the season has been brought low. She's abandoned by her house of abundance. She's tossed out by her sugar daddy boyfriend, Chris Maloney, after he disapproved of her getting gender affirmation surgery. And by the time Blanca comes across her at the beginning of this episode, Electra is stripping at a peep show and she's taking disco naps on the tabletops of diners. And it's all very sort of sad. And while their relationship, Electra and Blanca, is still formidable, or I'm sorry, it's still tense, Electra's pride is still formidable, and she is resistant at first to Blanca offering a hand, a helping hand. Ultimately, Blanca's able to convince her, though, and she brings her back home to live as a guest, which is, you know, a funny little situation. She puts out Damon and Ricky, the dancing boyfriends, who definitely bristle at Electra's sort of haughty demands. She wants a fresh coat of winter lilac paint in the bedroom because that's what she wants. And as she's sort of usurping their room, they at this point might be out of the house anyway pretty soon, because they are both successful at auditioning to dance on the Al Be Sure tour this summer. More on this in a moment. It definitely pays off. Blanca then pays a visit to Pray Tell, my neighbor. I'm pretty sure I know the house where they film the scenes at Pray Tell's house, which I'm pretty sure is like right around the corner from where I live, which is, I'm pretty sure, the house next door to the Royal Tenenbaum's house. So in my mind, in canon, in my head canon, Pray Tell and the Tenenbaums are neighbors, which is pretty cool. Pray Tell, at this point, his life, in his own words, has become a wash of gray. Since his partner recently died and he got his HIV diagnosis, Blanca wants to set him up on a date with this handsome man that she caught eyeing Pray Tell at the club recently. Pose, when it debuted, was a very important show for LGBTQ visibility, especially for queer and trans people of color. But as the season went on, what impressed to me was it became ever more exponentially lovable and just sort of like a show that you can really just kind of sink into and enjoy the characters. A lot of the credit for that goes to scenes like this one, where MJ Rodriguez and Billy Porter make Blanca and Pray Tell's friendship feel very lived in. Just this first bit of dialogue with Blanca twisting Pray's arm communicates such an easy and fun and watchable chemistry.
I think you should call him.
Oh, no. This shop is closed, honey. Out of business, and I don't have any plans of opening it up anytime soon. I do not need a man to make me happy, and I especially don't need to be dimming my shine by getting rejected for being positive. My heart needs a rest.
But you should have seen the way he was looking at you, and he was fine. You may be positive, but I know that hoe inside of you is thirsting for some fine-ass trade.
That is reformed hoe to you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So Mother Blanca then pays a visit to Damon's dance teacher at the Alvin Ailey School, where she gets the great news that his scholarship has been extended for a year. All in all, some really great reviews for Blanca's mothering. She then, takes Electra out on a job interview to be a hostess at the restaurant Indochine, which we later find out was a successful interview when Elektra, in all her imperious glory, is there to seat Prey Tell and his date, whose name is Keenan. Prey does the hard thing on this date and tells Keenan the truth about his HIV diagnosis up front. Keenan is compassionate and accepting, and it's a fairly idealized response from him. But I would say, after what we have seen Prey go through this season already, I will accept some idealized good news for him for a change. Next is Blanca and Angel. Angel is still reeling from her breakup with Stan, the Evan Peters character. Blanca decides this is the moment she's going to tell Angel that she has also tested HIV positive, which partially seems like an effort to get Angel sort of snapped back into reality, since Angel now knows she's going to have to take over as mother of the house one day. Clip number two.
I tested positive. I need you to take care of this house. Okay? It's not tomorrow, but it's sooner than you think. You are going to be a mother to all these children and many more. And no white boy from the suburbs is going to rescue you. We're the only ones who got each other's back.
Later, later at family dinner with special guest Elektra playing the hothouse flower at the table, Damon and Ricky give Blanca the good news that they got the gig dancing on the Al B. Shore tour, at which point Elektra delivers my favorite moment of the episode and maybe the season, reacting to the mere mention of Al B. Shore the way that Lucille Bluth reacts to an appearance by Jean Parmesan.
Well, we audition for Al B. Shore's next video.
What? I love Al B. Shore. Holy shit, he's the Marvin Gaye of our time. Dick and I made love to him at least twice a week. Ooh, nothing or no one is a panty dropper like Al B. Shore.
Dave's like, is that a real person?
Oh, so very real. One of the things about Pose and the casting of the show especially is that in casting sort of rigorously for trans actors and actresses playing trans roles, the authenticity of that the show gets, there was especially in the early part of the season, sometimes a little bit of a trade-off in terms of experience and technique and letting the acting sort of shine through. I think the kind of clipped delivery that Elektra would sometimes give sometimes would feel a little bit awkward over the season. I think it's all worth it for the way that she says panty dropper in that moment right there. It is, it's so much of the show sort of comes together in this episode. I really love it. So while Blanca is not thrilled about Damon skipping out on a second year of dance school to go out on tour, especially go out on tour with his boyfriend, she says she won't stop him. She's not that kind of mother. Later on in the episode, Damon ends up telling her that he is, in fact, going to let Ricky go out on tour, and he's going to stick around, and he's going to do his second year of dance school. So everything sort of works out there. We then get the obligatory scene with the white folks in which Kate Mara's Patty gives Evan Peters' Stan sort of the lay of the land about how their post-separation life is going to look, including her taking college classes and him giving up his big banking job so he can spend more time with the kids. I am reminded at this point of my hope that FX and Ryan Murphy at some point realize that the show is strong enough to stand without these token white people standing in as this like attempt at a mainstream audience surrogate. We don't need it. Honestly, we good. Like, we're real good. Patty got her one great scene in the, I think it was the episode directly before this one, where she and Angel sort of have their little moment and face off. And I thought that was really good, but we had it and it's good. And maybe we can leave it all at that. So we'll see for season two. The remainder of this episode is dedicated to the much hyped Princess Ball, where the House of Evangelista challenges the even newer House of Ferocity, which was assembled by Elektra's outcasts Candy and Lulu and is a rather mean little ragtag bunch of queens. To quote another of my favorite podcasts, Les Culturistas, while podcasts are famously a visual medium, I cannot do justice to the performance visuals of what goes down at the Princess Ball. It is too bad because there is, it is by far the show's best depiction of a full sleigh drag ball. It is quite something to behold from beginning to end. Candy and Lulu show up, try to bully Blanca with their shade, but Electra steps in and reads the full house down on Candy and Lulu and any other member of Ferocity who crosses her. She even manages to liberate poor outcast Cubby and Lamar and Lil Poppy Evangelista, all of whom return to Blanca's warming embrace. And then it's the Evangelista versus Ferocity walk-off challenge, and oh my god, it is so good. The whole extended walk-off is on YouTube. Do yourselves a favor, go and watch it, all of it. It's so good. Billy Porter's MC work is season best stuff. Every single member of the cast is performing, darling. It is like full on amazing. Even though you can't get visuals, I just wanted to clip this little bit just to get a taste of what Billy Porter is doing on commentary.
Oh, and the wrath of Mother Blanca Evangelista versus the statement Lulu Ferocity giving us Jessica Rabbit. Y'all know what I'm talking about. Blanca, you better turn up, bitch. This Lulu is at your neck. Ha-ha, don't get chopped. Tonight, everything is on the line. Work it out, work it out, work it out. And pose, 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 and pose.
That last little bit where it's and pose, and everybody in the room is saying it, and everyone is just sort of in this mass at the middle of the room. It really felt like almost like a cast party. It felt like this was the last scene of the season that they filmed and everybody got together in this, you know, they're saying the name of the show that they're on. It felt like a real celebration of what a victory this season of TV was. I scream, I yell, I cry every time I watch this. It's so good. And then after that whole like insane show, there's a whole mess of nonsense with Candy Ferocity trying to Vogue, which is hilarious. She fails miserably. Pray Tell sort of like reads her down. And then Candy nearly starts a fight with a tack hammer where she sort of skitters onto the middle of the runway back with her tack hammer in the most gifable moment I've ever seen, where it looks like she's just sort of like on rails. It's amazing. And then we get a scene where Stan tries unsuccessfully to win Angel back outside. She stands up for herself in a really good moment. And I think it also feels like there's plausible finality to that. So again, cross our fingers. We don't have to see them anymore. And then we get the moment back inside where Blanca wins the trophy for Mother of the Year, a moment that I will say rivals Buffy winning Class Protector at the prom in terms of well-earned sentiment in this kind of a setting. So that's clip number 5.
The recipient has taught us that a house is much more than a home. It's family. And every family needs a mother who is affirming, caring, loyal, and inspiring. This woman is that and much, much, much more. She has saved many a soul lost in darkness simply by shining her light. I know this to be true because that is how she saved mine. The 1988 award for Mother of the Year goes to my sister, Blanca Evangelista.
The drama, the tears, the acting. I don't know a better person. I don't deserve a better person. It is all of it. It's so good. Billy Porter should get 12 Emmys. It's all fantastic. Thank you for indulging me. I know this presentation was pretty long. It's an episode that does mean a lot to me, and I think it is the perfect encapsulation of what makes Pose such a vital and important and deeply, deeply lovable television show. So now I will hand it over to you.
This was an excellent presentation. I told you in an email that I had been had it in the back of my mind that I should do the series premiere of Pose. So now I still can because you did this, but I'll just go through the main threads. I agree with you, particularly about the acting, the caliber of acting from some of the performers we're seeing, especially when they have to act opposite Billy Porter. Like, they are not.
Yeah.
Especially right. Earlier in the season, more so than at the end, you really see it. But Dominique Jackson is the one that I think has come the longest way. And her in that opening montage of Elektra, you know, brought low because of the decisions that she made to be herself. Like, she's just so heartbreaking without saying a word. She's great. Seeing her walk down the street with Blanca going to the job interview, like 9 feet tall and thinking that she's not ready. Like, she's just she strikes such a gorgeous figure. And, you're right that I had to pause after the I'll Be Sure freak out and try to like impress upon Dave, like, no, this is so out of character. Like, nothing we had seen her do the entire rest of the whole season would have prepared us for that. What? Like, she just nails it. So she's great. This not enough beautiful angel in this episode. I agree with you about Stan and Mrs. Stan. Fuck off forever. They could have lost that scene between them. No one cares. It would have been enough for him to just show up and at the ball and say he was going to rescue her and get the kiss off. Like, that would have been fine. No one gives a fuck about Patty. Get the fuck out of here. I think it's a beautiful showcase for Blanca. Obviously, you know, it's Mother of the Year. This is her episode, and like all of the beats of where she goes and over the course of her day. The scene between her and Helena at the dance school, I thought, was especially nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought two things. One was that this was one of the episodes I put on my top 10 of the year for the Slate TV Club. And one of the other critics, I think it was Sonia Soraya, said that she liked Pose but didn't love it because she felt like, you know, the characters got off too easy sometimes. And it was like the portrayal of them was so saintly. And I get that. And you sort of hinted at that in your presentation, too, that like it's the moment between Keenan and Pray Tell, it's like an idealized version of how that conversation would go, but you'll allow it because he needs it. And I feel like that about the whole show. Like, when we're in a TV climate where there are more than one show about trans people written and created by trans people, like, do whatever you want. Tell your story. Like, I don't even count Transparent. Jill Soloway is not trans.
Yeah.
And that character was whatever, not played by a trans person, her lead. You know, if this is your time and you want to, this is the story you want to tell, fucking tell it. It's not my place to say that this is, you know, it needs to be more gritty. It was plenty gritty for me, I thought.
Yeah.
This season, I don't think anyone got off easy, but this was just it was a lovely valedictory for the end. And I also loved, we heard it in your first clip of Blanca and Pray Tell, that the language that kept coming up about how no one wanted to dim their shine. It was all about, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought that's such a great way to close things off. And it's such an evocative way to describe what these characters are trying to do in the world that, you know, in a lot of cases doesn't want them to be there, and they don't care, and they're not going to dim their shine. And it's lovely. This is a great presentation. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Sarah.
This was a great presentation. I had not gotten around to watching the show, and I did not need this to be any grittier. I think that just the reality in which these characters are dwelling in terms of their timeline and their diagnoses is plenty of grit. Thanks for your help, Ronald Reagan. Just kidding. Burn in hell. The opening montage particularly was just suffused with exhaustion and was devastating.
Yeah.
However, MJ Rodriguez is not up to the task, I feel, of Blanca. And it just, like, the line readings, they may have improved, and I don't know, but I just felt... I just felt taken out of certain scenes emotionally by a sameness of the line readings, and the writing is also not necessarily helping her and other performers. There were a handful of reads that felt not like just not good enough. Like, I just wanted them to be better. I wanted lines to be jumped. I wanted it to be a little less. I mean, I know the point of it is a certain staginess, but this was not like a staginess germane to the genre. There were like a couple of clunky, like the scene with the dance teacher. I felt like, is this an homage to equally sort of plant your feet and deliver scenes in Fame, the TV show? Because if so, I'm here for that. If not, it just felt distractingly pat. I don't know, but I have not been on the journey with these characters. So I think there is context that I lack that I wanted to try to grade on a curve for that. But unfortunately, I wanted to love it and just liked it. I mean, Billy Porter is a national treasure and it, you know, could have been in every scene and I would have been fine with that. But the rest of it felt just not quite hooked to me. And I don't know if watching the whole season up to this point would have changed my opinion on that, but I'm sort of at like it and not love it. Also, love the presentation, but the actual episode, not sure it's quite there. Dave Cole.
I have some stupid questions probably, but I'm going to ask them anyways. So house culture, right? And the idea of a mother sort of at the head of a house that sort of takes care of people that perform at
balls.
Is that, where did that start? Let me ask that question. Like location wise, but like culture wise, is that like a Chelsea thing? Is this a Harlem thing?
This is a Harlem in the Bronx kind of a thing. It's definitely like uptown.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So given that context that, you know, we're talking about a minority of a minority, you know, where this culture is coming up, the Evan Peters storyline, like even just watching this one episode and just kind of being in the room while Tara's watching the rest of the season, you could just tell that that was just a network note that they couldn't get around, you know, like there needed to be a white guy in there.
It really feels that way.
It really does. Like it feels so side dishy to the rest of the and unnecessary. We have this white guy who lives out in the sticks, Jersey or something, or at least, you know, somewhere else. And, you know, he comes to town once in a while to see, who is it? Angel?
Angel.
Yeah. Yeah. Is seeing Angel. And he should be there as a catalyst for something in Angel's life. His storyline isn't his storyline. And that's the way they present him.
This episode doesn't even have James Vanderbeek in it, which is like already makes it better. Like, I don't mind James Vanderbeek, but like the fact that they fleshed out that part of the story so much that like there were like conflicts between the two of them about business. Like, do not care.
I did see that episode as well. And you are totally right. It was like, what is this show in a show? That is an easy cut. I think the show is instructional celebration, right? It is for some a glimpse into this culture that they've never seen before, me, but also a celebration of that culture and sort of like being in a Russian doll of terrible circumstances, both era, socioeconomic, and everything that's going against them in 1988. I was really super interested in the concept and the mechanics and politics of a household and how that works and how some seem to be collegiate and some seem to be more of a family. Like some seem to be built to win. Some seem to be built to take care of people.
Like a group living kind
of thing. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I thought that was very interesting. And also just the actual club scene, competitions, and Pray Tell is like one of my new favorite characters on television.
He's so good.
I am I said to Tari, he's like a spelt LL Cool J, but like even cooler. What do I know him from? Anything else?
He's mostly a Broadway guy. Oh, he won a Tony Award for Kinky Boots on Broadway.
I think his projection on Broadway really pays off as the MC of the ball. Like that was like commanding.
There are little parts in that where when they're doing the performances where he'll just be like, you know, he'll call out little aspects of what they're doing, like when they're dancing, and he'll just be like, no touching when they're not supposed to, like when they're sort of like dance fighting, but they're not supposed to make contact. And and when he'll call out like Candy for getting her sort of like ass injections or whatever. And she got the body and that was good, but you can't dance and that whole kind of thing. There's an order to it. There's a structure that I like.
Absolutely. I feel like it's almost, and this talking about other worlds I know nothing about, but it's almost like when you get a sports color commentary guy who both knows how to talk, but it's also played the game long enough that he knows all the stupid little shit that just the talking head guys don't.
Yeah.
And I feel like you get the best of both worlds. I feel like that's the case here, where you're getting somebody, a character that knows how to command a scene, but has also been in the game. You were talking about something, you mentioned disco naps right at the start of your thing. Is that an actual thing people call those, disco naps, where you go into a diner or something, have a little snooze?
Yeah.
Because I live near this coffee shop here in Austin, and between the hours of 3 a.m. and, say, 6 a.m., which sometimes I end up there when I can't sleep, boy, disco napping. Like, there'll be like three or four people.
People be disco napping.
Yeah, having a disco nap. There's one guy there that has a disco PlayStation nap, which is he brings a TV, his PlayStation 4, sometimes plays it, and I've seen him fall asleep as he's playing a video game, and then like wakes up 10 minutes later and like just continues where he was. It's kind of fascinating to watch. This was great. I really enjoyed it. It makes me want to go back and watch the whole series. I felt the characters were fantastic. And I thought it was a revelation on all fronts. Let's just lose the white dude. And I think we got a even better show.
I think we got a show here.
Evergreen.
Let's put it to a vote. Tari Ariana.
Yay.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Nay, sorry. Good presentation, but doesn't need my help, I don't think.
I'm going to say yes. So... Pose Season 1, Episode 8, Mother of the Year. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Gray Canon. And pose, and pose, and pose, and pose.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Sarah has our winner.
The loser may be my pronunciation of this last name. Does anyone else who's looking at the document have any suggestions, or shall I just take a run at it?
My best guess would be Hanschak.
Hanschak, maybe? Yeah,
I'd go with Hanschak, but that sounds disgusting. So,
Hacky Sack, yeah.
First name Mackenzie. She plays Teen Kate on This Is Us, and she was selling Girl Scout cookies at the SAG Awards as a Girl Scout saleswoman emerita. You got to do whatever it takes. Go ahead. I hope you filled up that sheet.
Okay, loser of the week.
Well, we all know by now Terry Crews has made allegations of sexual assault against a former agent at the William Morris agency named Adam Bennett. For some reason, D.L. Hughley decided to go on something called Vlad TV. I assume it's a podcast of some sort, and basically imply that Terry Crews didn't do enough to prevent this from happening. And so Terry Crews kind of called him out on Twitter to say, like, you said I should have pushed him away. I should have told him to stop, whatever. I did all of those things. So what are you suggesting that I wanted to be sexually assaulted? And D.L. Hughley, for some reason, responded that none of what you're describing is the same as slapping the shit out of him. And Terry Crews was like, okay, well, I don't want this to happen either. So should I slap the shit out of you? Now, D.L. Hughley has not responded, so obviously the answer to violence is not more violence. But if D.L. Hughley isn't going to shut the fuck up, then maybe you have no options. So
D.L. Hughley wants none of that. I can guarantee everybody that. Like, good Lord. Jesus.
Speaking about Yao, do you know what time it is? It's game time. All right, everybody, this is the second game time of this season. Season scores, Tara 1, everybody else 0. Today we are playing Schools In from Mademoiselle Caroline from France, who earns herself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic of her choosing. Okay, Caroline, who we've just discovered is a school teacher, has constructed a school-related quiz decathlon that'll test your knowledge of TV schools and TV educators. We have 6 rounds, and each has their own format, so we'll explain each as we reach that point in the exam. Tara, steel mail situation, please.
Okay. Sarah has 3. I have 3. Valued guest has 1.
All right, let's hope to Picky see who's going first.
We will start with valued guest.
Oh, okay. So Joe is going first, and then we'll go Sarah, then Tara. Are we ready to play School's In?
Yes.
All right, here we go, Joe. Round one, the best teachers. The best teachers. I'll read you a question. You give me the teacher and the show. Ready? 1 point.
Okay.
This teacher was on a TGIF show in the 90s. For some eerie reason, his career path followed the main character's academic career throughout the series. He began by being a sixth grade teacher, then became the principal of the boys' high school, and then finally they meet again at college where he somehow becomes a professor. That's commitment. Who's that? Who's that educator? What's that show?
I'm pretty sure this is Mr. Feeny on Boy Meets World.
You are correct. That's good for a point.
All right.
Okay. To Sarah. In the 1970s on ABC, you couldn't find a better teacher than this New York high school teacher, plus excellent afro. Mwah.
That is true. That is Mr. Cotter on Welcome Back, Cotter.
Correct. Tara?
Yes.
In the 80s on ABC, if you were a gifted student on an honor program, this substitute teacher became your full-time history teacher. Although unconventional in his methods, he was just what was needed.
Ugh, it's head of the class, but I can't remember his name. The Howard Hessman guy.
Well, you are correct. That's Charlie Moore from Head of the Class. Tough question, though.
Mr. Fever.
All right, Joe, your second question of round one. On this streaming platform, this middle school science teacher is excellent. He helps his nerdy students on scientific experiments, which in turn help them deal with their supernatural problems.
Oh, God.
Streaming platform, middle school science teacher. Helps
sure
his nerdy
like
students
on
scientific
things.
Experiments, which help them with their supernatural problems.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what the name of the teacher is.
What's
the
show?
Mustache guy.
Stranger Things, I would imagine.
Stranger Things. This is the show. Scott Clark. Scott Clark.
Sure.
All right, back to Sarah, your second question. On this 1970s NBC drama, the village school teacher is worshipped by her students, except for the very badly behaved one. She will encourage the main character to get an education, even if it's not so easy for a girl in pioneer days.
Oh, God. What the fuck was her name? It's Little House on the Prairie. Spirit of Kim, watch over me.
I know.
Miss Beetle?
Nice.
Oh, thank you.
All right, this will end round one for Tara.
Yep.
There is no better high school football coach than this one on NBC. He is inspirational, supportive, but can also kick your butt if it needs kicking.
That's Coach Taylor of Friday Night Lights.
That it is. All right, quickly the scores.
All right, very close game. Joe and I are tied with 1 point each. Sarah DeBenting has two.
All right, round two. The worst teachers. The worst teachers. Joe. In this series from Fox, this high school coach berates her own students and is ready to do anything to undermine the students of her colleague and arch enemy.
This would be Sue Sylvester on Glee.
Sarah. This AMC series science teacher went from a man who teaches teens to one who watches over them, watches them overdose and die without so much as a hint of remorse.
Oh, well, there was maybe a hint. Walter White on Breaking Bad.
You are correct. Tara. On this long-standing series on Fox, this chain-smoking fourth-grade teacher is far more interested in finding a romantic partner than her youngsters' futures. Although with students like the main character, one may understand.
That's Mrs. Crabapple on The Simpsons.
I've been calling her Crabapple.
I knew someone was going to say it.
Back to Joe.
Francais. I know it's not her, but.
This high school teacher on a recent ABC Family Freeform night soap is the worst. He makes out with a 6-year-old student before he's aware of her age, but then continues the relationship once the situation is revealed.
Shit. My sister and I were just talking about this. Wait. It's Pretty Little Liars, and it's Ezra something.
That's good enough for me. Ezra Fitz.
That's good enough for me, too.
Fitz. Nice.
Go ahead, Joe.
Whew. All right, Sarah. On this long-standing Comedy Central show, this primary school teacher is way, way, way too attached to his puppet. And he uses it to teach very, very inappropriate things to the four main characters who attend his class.
I have no idea. Someone should steel mail this because I don't know what that is.
Steel mail.
All right.
That's Mr. Garrison on South Park.
Oh!
There it is.
I got thrown by the puppet thing. I thought it was a whole puppet show. Okay.
On this recent NBC sitcom, this college teacher teaches Spanish, although he really doesn't speak the language. He will then have to attend said college as a resentful student.
Oh, no. It's Community, and it's Ken Jeong, but I don't remember his name either. Anyone?
No, it's not coming to me.
Senior Chang from Community.
Chang!
All right. That's round two. Scores, please, Tara.
Well, it only got closer because now we're all tied up.
Holy
shit.
3
points each.
Nice. All right. Round three, guys. A student report cards. A students. All right. On this recently canceled mockumentary, this is for Joe, these two students have displayed the kind of qualities one hopes to find in students: an appreciation for research, follow through, and a clear sense of ethics. All of which help them navigate the various disgusting mysteries taking place at their school. I just need the show for the point.
Sorry, could you give that to me one more time?
Recently canceled mockumentary. These two students have displayed the kind of qualities one hopes to find in students. A, an appreciation of research. B, follow through. And C, a clear sense of ethics. All of these qualities help them navigate the various disgusting mysteries taking place at their school. What's that show? And if you want to show off, what are those names?
Oh, this is not coming to me at all. It feels like it's something that I should know.
Probably should.
I don't know if you watched this.
Oh.
Mockumentary.
Yes.
Ethics. Children. Television.
Future.
I don't know.
Steel Meal.
Yeah.
American Vandal.
Oh, joy. I did watch it. Yeah.
All right. Do you know the characters' names?
Sam and the other kid.
Yeah, Sam and Peter.
Peter?
Yep. Peter. Yeah.
Okay, Sarah, here's your actual question. This blue-eyed, bookish, straight-A's girl student was on a WBCW series of the aughts. After a rough beginning at her new prep school, she managed to turn enemies into friends and eventually became a valedictorian of her class.
What? Ooh. Buffy? I don't actually know.
Anybody?
Yeah, I'll steel mail that. It's Rory Gilmore of Gilmore Girls.
Oh, yeah.
That correct. Bitch. All right, Tara. Last question of round three. On this MTV Aughts series, the most intelligent and deserving clone of French heroine is, of course, neglected by the boy she loves because that's how it goes.
That's Joan of Arc.
Yes, it is.
Correct. All right. And that's round three. Scores, please, Dar.
Still super close. Joe has 3. Sarah has 4. I have 5.
All right. 3, 4, 5. Who has 3?
Joseph.
Right,
this is my first.
Adam Grossworth, he of the Rent Party, Equalizer Challenge Zone. Joe, you have to answer 3 of these 6 mid-90s Trivia Pursuit questions correctly to get 2 points.
Okay.
Here we go. Starting off with classics. The glasses are on. The light is on. Here we go.
Good luck, Joe.
What comedian's characters included the mean Waddle Kid, Sheriff Deadeye, and Clem...
Cadiddlehopper. It's Cadiddlehopper.
It's Cadiddlehopper,
boy.
Yes,
she says with authority.
Oh, boy.
Sarah's explain later.
Holy shit. How old are you, Sarah?
I have old parents. Let's leave it there.
Okay. And a clarification. This is not questions about the mid-90s. It is a
no,
mid-90s.
No, that's when the
game
box
is from
dates
the
from.
Right. I have no idea.
Yeah. I do.
Sarah?
Sarah?
It's a Red Skelton.
Oh,
boy.
Wow.
Fucking kill me. Class
Cadiddlehopper. Most embarrassing correction ever. Sitcoms. What show did Good Times spin off from?
Okay, Good Times spun off, I'm pretty sure, from Maud.
Yeah!
Nice. Yay.
Correct. Drama. What medical drama was ABC's first series to top the ratings for a full season in 1970-71?
Medical series. Sorry, can you say that one more time?
Yeah. First drama that topped the ratings for a full season. Medical drama 70-71, ABC.
Marcus Welby? Yeah!
What?
Now, it's Marcus Welby MD, but...
Right, yeah, Marcus Welby MD.
I think that's fine.
Yeah. All right, so you only need one more. You got three left. You only need one of them. Kids and Games. Who was King Leonardo's loyal skunk?
That's it? That's no more...
Yeah.
Just King Leonardo's loyal skunk? Yeah. No idea.
No idea.
Mr. Rogers' question? I have no
Sarah,
idea.
What is it?
I don't know. Lemkin Idlehopper.
Extra Hot Grade's favorite octogenarian, Sarah, says, don't know. That's Odie Coloni.
Yeah, no idea.
I never heard of that.
Stars. Okay, your answer is a celebrity. Stars.
Okay.
What Murder, She Wrote star got the urge to diet from seeing a home video of herself at her son's birthday party?
The only Murder, She Wrote star I know of is Angela Lansbury, so that's my only option.
Correct.
Yay!
All right, you got points. Chits and giggles, let's do the wild card. What was ABC's answer to 60 Minutes?
2020, right?
2020, yeah.
2020 is correct. All right.
Yeah.
So, corrected scores, please, Tara.
All right. Well, now Sarah has 4 points. Joe and I are tied with 5 each.
Woo!
Still
all right.
Very nicely. Close.
But those are 1868 points. 2019, it's actually like 88 points.
Yeah, they're worth a lot more now.
Round 4, F student report cards. All right, here's our shitty students round, starting with Joe. This Californian high school student on an NBC show of the late 80s, early 90s, is a disgrace. He lies all the time to his parents and teachers, hardly ever attends class, and he usually spends his time in the principal's office.
This sounds like Zach Morris on Saved by the Bell.
Whoa! Nice.
Sarah, on this relatively recent NBC sitcom that doesn't take place in a school environment, this little punk made an impression in 2 different episodes, ruining Halloween by vandalizing parks despite the best efforts of a diligent City Hall employee to stop him. Who's this shitty student? What show? Only need the show for the point.
Parks and Rec?
Nice.
That's Greg.
Greg Pekaitis.
Right. Yeah.
Pekaitis.
Okay. Tara.
Yes.
On this recent ABC sitcom, beloved by one of the Extra Hot Great panel, the older kid is your typical lazy, somewhat dim-witted boy who somehow got to go to college thanks to a football scholarship.
Oh, this is Axel of the Middle.
Yeah, good thing that one person, in fact, is you.
Yeah. Jeff,
all right, that's round 4.
All right, well, Sarah's got 5. Joe and I each have 6.
All right, so we got 2 rounds left. This round is school theme song. School theme song.
Okay.
Name the TV series primarily taking place in a school from this snippet of the theme. Joe.
Yes. Please pause while I slink dreamily into my seat here. And imagine a better, younger time. That's my so-called life.
I was going to say, if you didn't get that one, you would be assassinated tonight.
Yes, both your co-hosts are coming to your house.
All right, so I feel like Joe got the one that maybe Sarah was destined for, so let's see how the inverse works. Sarah, here's yours.
Excuse me.
I don't know. Steel
Mail. Steel Mail. That's Daria.
Joe with the steel mill gets it.
All right, Joe, you're out
picky,
of steel.
You fickle mistress. Tara.
Yeah. Freaks and Geeks.
Freaks and Geeks, correct. All right, back to Joe for your second theme.
Shit. Shit.
I know I've been abusing this, but can I hear it one more time? Jim. Okay. Jim. Joe.
Jim.
Jim.
This is the toughest one. Yeah. It sounds... Oh, it's... Can I hear it one more time?
You sure can. Okay.
I am right on the cusp of it and I can't get it. It's going to kill me. I can't.
Anybody?
I'm not going to steel meal it, but I have a guess.
Okay, guess. Same.
Is it Doug?
No, it's not.
No. Oh.
I was going to go with Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
That is correct.
That's
what it is. That's a really good theme song.
Hot
I forgot
damn.
About that.
Yeah.
Good job, Sarah.
Okay, Sarah, here is your theme.
You could stop. This theme song's terrible. This is 21 Jump Street.
It really is.
Oh. Brutal.
Well done. 21 Jump Street was the answer. Tara, here's our last theme of Round 5.
Okay.
I know my parents loved me.
I think Tara probably knows this one.
While I blow a kiss at myself in the mirror, that's a different world.
Sorry.
That answer again, please.
A different world. That was the most wonderful way to honor the late Queen of Soul, Jeff. Yeah.
All right, that is round 5, so let's get the scores.
Oh, all right. Sarah's got 6 points. Joe and I have 8 points.
You know, we got another one.
Woo, get it, Sarah!
All right, Sarah, that means if you can win this Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone, our game will be tied. Here we go.
Come on.
Classics.
Shut up, Dave.
What boxing telecast featured announcer Jimmy Powers from 1949 to 1960? You should get this. What boxing telecast? So what was the name of the show?
Wide World of Sports?
Okay, if you get this, instant win. It is not the Wide World of Sports.
Boxing in America? Boxing Night in America?
It is not, but this is a great name. The Gillette Cavalcade of Sports.
That is good.
Hosted by Red Skelton.
And Skedaddle McLefthook. Sitcom.
Fuck.
What solid state character, lived in a world where it was illegal to turn off a TV set? Sitcoms.
Don't say me.
Max Headroom?
Yay!
Nice.
Dramas. What was the longest continuously running cop series in TV history as of this, whenever this was?
As of that card?
Yeah, as of this card.
Oh.
Card time.
Continuously running.
Cop series. In TV history.
In TV history. What's the matter? You don't like Bonanza? I don't know. Dragnet.
Mahalo nui loa for trying, but that was Y5O.
Oh.
All right. You've got one. You need 2 of these last 3.
All right.
Kids and Games. What character was added to assist Astro Boy late in the show's run?
Astro Girl. Jesus. Is that her Astro Dog?
That's what I would have said.
That was the coin flip for sure. Stars. What Hollywood star played Evita Perón, Queen Isabella, and the Duchess of Windsor in made-for-TV movies? Eva Perón, Queen Isabella, and the Duchess of Windsor, all played by this Hollywood star.
Hollywood star. I mean, well, fuck it. Olivia de Havilland.
Oh. Man, that was
decent guess. The answer was Faye Dunaway.
Oh.
All right. You got to get this. This is a wild card category. Oh, I am going to say, I think your odds are pretty good. We're talking, boy, I don't know. I'm giving you a 50-50 chance on this one.
Thanks for jinxing it.
It depends on your knowledge. Jesus. It depends on your knowledge of the source, but here we go. What 1939 classic became the highest rated movie ever aired on TV in 1976? So what movie from 39 got the highest ratings ever when aired in 76?
It's a documentary based on my life. Just kidding. I believe this is Gone with the Wind.
Correct. All right, we don't need the scores. We know they're tied up going into our final round.
Yeah, we got all 8 points each.
All eights.
All
right, so round six is very important. And round six is called Listen to the Teacher. And listen you must. Okay. Guess the name of the teacher mentor from the clip from the show. Are you ready?
Oh.
Yes.
There we go. Joe Reed.
Right. So when Rigby got his samples back from the laboratory... He made a startling discovery. What he believed to be igneous was in fact sedimentary.
This would be fraudulent Ross Geller on Friends.
You are correct. Ross All right, Geller. Joe's got the point. Can Sarah get the point?
Finally, my first class had arrived. For real this time. I knew I had to make a strong impression. I had thought of everything, except...
Wait. Does Professor have one F or two? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Professor. Professor.
That's going to be you tomorrow.
I mean...
Buncey.
It has one F, and I am getting the other F for not knowing this, but I don't know who that is.
That is...
Steel Meal!
Damn it.
It's Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother.
That is...
Now I am Joe. out of steel meals.
I was out of steel meals. I knew it, but I was out of steel meals. Damn it, other guests.
We got Joe and Tara tied with Sarah one behind. Yep. And it is Tara's clip. Here we go.
Dan was wondering if he could trail with us today.
Good God in heaven, Newbie. There are just so very many ways for me to say this to you. Never, not in a million years, absolutely not, no way Jose, no chance Lance, and yet, negatory, and of course my own personal favorite of all time, man falling off of a cliff. No!
All right, who's that educator?
That's Dr. Cox.
Dr. Cox from Scrubs, correct. All right, so we've got Tara in the lead, one behind Joe, Sarah, correct?
Correct. Yep. Sarah's
Everybody's
got eight,
one
Joe's
question
got nine,
left, so make
ten.
It count.
Oh, good luck, everybody.
All right, Joe, I don't need a character name, okay? You can just, we'll go through the clip. You just have to explain who it is, all right?
Okay.
Okay, let's take a roll here. Jay Quellen. Where's Jay Quellen at? No Jay Quellen here? Yeah.
Do you mean Jacqueline?
Okay, so that's how it's gonna be. Y'all wanna play. Okay, then. I've got my eye on you, Jay Quellen.
This is the Key and Peele teacher who can't pronounce names.
That's good enough. Yeah. Substitute teacher sketch is what we're going for. Yeah. And you got the point.
Good job.
Sarah, here is your last question of the game.
Do you want me to wag my finger at you and tell you that you acted rashly?
Aww.
You did. And I can.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you loved him. And he has proven more than once that he loved you. You couldn't have known what would happen. The coming months are going to be hard. I suspect on all of us, but...
Yeah, they were, but you were great. Rupert Giles of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
You are correct.
The best.
All right. Tara.
Yes.
Answer to win the game.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
It should take 70 seconds for you to fully gauge someone's character. Here's what to look for. Grammar, posture, scent, attire, level of perspiration, type of shirt collar.
What's the best type of shirt collar?
English spread, obviously, but let's hold the questions until the end. When people say good morning, they mean hello.
That's Captain Holt from
Britain.
All right, let's get scores, please, Star.
All right, that was close right to the end. Yeah. Great job, everybody. Sarah ended with 9. Joe had 10. I had 11.
Well done, everyone.
But let's do the tiebreaker.
Okay.
We're going to give two steel meals for this. So
okay.
Not a bad prize.
No.
I am going to read you a top line of the resume. You tell me who this is. Are you ready?
Yes.
Yes.
50-ish substitute teacher in the greater Miami area, specialty English literature.
Dorothy Zbornak.
Oh, yeah.
Nicely done.
Is correct. But wait, guys. Nice. We have to find out who's been a good student, and we need to find out the Dave point totals.
Oh, my. Well, since we've been keeping track of them, okay, Sarah has, since they last reset, Sarah's got 8. I have 12, and the valued guests have 23.
Wow. Well, you know what that means? Dave points win the day, so...
Yeah!
Valued guess.
You know, the last time this happened, I was sitting in between these two, and I'm really glad that's not the case right now.
Value guess with the Dave point victory on this fine day.
Thank God this is not in person.
Thank you, fellow guests.
Thank Clem Kadiddlehoppers, Restless Ghost.
Sarah, are you keeping track on how to, like, my tips on how to run a classroom? Start handing out Sarah points on day one. Cash them in at the end of the year.
Yes, I have carved them into the top of my laptop desk.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra. Aha, great. We glommed on to the other two's early success before going around the dial with stops at The Good Place, Rent Live, QB1, and Unbreakable, Kimmy Schmidt. We explained why we weren't technically into certain quality shows, but were into Joe's canon entry for Pose's Mother of the Year. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Joe, with his superior pop culture brain, was the winner of this week's Educational Game Time. Dick. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Arianna,
what?
Sarah T. Bunting,
Red Skelton,
and Joe Reed.
We all have very clean buttholes.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra. Not great.
Well, take a long last look at this filet mignon. I doubt we'll be conversing ever again unless I take a sudden interest in dying of boredom.